Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held in Rotterdam in September. In this episode, we're focusing on cognitive health. Can the right nutrients in early life protect your brain decades later? And are we missing critical brain-boosting compounds in our daily diets?
So, welcome to the last session of today here, but a very exciting topic. So, great that you're here. We will talk about innovative ingredients for cognitive health and well-being. And actually, it's nice because the speakers will also touch upon the life stages and different elements of cognitive health. So really great. Is there a connection between food and mood? There is a lot of new science on the gut-brain axis. So I think this is really a relevant topic that we are going to discuss. And actually, the first speaker I would like to ask to the stage is Dr. Sophie Putnam. She is head of science at Holland & Barrett. And she will talk about innovative ingredients for cognitive health in the broad sense of the word, many aspects, and well-being throughout the life stages. So welcome to the stage. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for having me here today. I'm Sophie Putnam. I'm head of science for Holland & Barrett. Today, I'm going to be talking through innovative ingredients, bit of a mouthful, for cognitive health and well-being through the life stages. So I just wanted to start off by giving a bit of background to our science team at Holland & Barrett and Holland & Barrett a bit more broadly. Now, I think for those of you from the UK and also from Benelux, you hopefully will have seen some of our Holland & Barrett stores on your high streets. You may or may not be familiar with them. But what you might not be familiar with is the fact that we have a science team at Holland & Barrett. Now, I actually joined Holland & Barrett just over a year ago. And our science team, you could count on one hand, right? There were five of us. It was a very small team. Now, over the last year, since June specifically, we have grown to a team of 20. So why am I telling you that? Well, one, you might not know. It's an interesting fact. But also, it does reflect Holland & Barrett's investment in science more generally. So we have quite a bold ambition, I think. Personally, I think it's bold. And probably my team too, because we're very busy. But we want to be known for science, and we want to ensure a science-led approach to all of our products, our services, and every solution that we're providing to our customers. So that's just the little kind of Holland & Barrett sales pitch at the beginning. We'll move on to the more interesting stuff now around cognitive function. So I'm going to start off maybe by scaring you, maybe not. This first stat scared me. So we know, I think, most of us in the room, that cognitive decline is a global health concern. I don't think that's new news. But when you do look at the statistics, it is quite scary, at least to me. So 50 million people in the world globally are living with dementia. And even more scarily, that is actually set to triple, not just double, triple by 2050, which, again, not that far away. One in four older adults as well, in Europe specifically, report subjective cognitive impairment. So that's 25% of older adults, probably our grandparents, some of us our parents, functioning at suboptimal levels of cognitive function. And then in the younger population, one in five UK adults report low productivity and performance due to high pressure, stress. Again, nothing new, but it's quite a high statistic in my opinion. And so it can be seen that optimizing and maintaining brain health is vital. Neurological conditions cause the greatest loss of what we call healthy life years. So we know as a population, we are living longer, generally speaking. And we want to make sure that those longer years that we are living are quality years. We don't want to be living with lower quality of life. Now, cognitive decline and aging is one end of the spectrum. But we know that cognitive needs evolve throughout the life course. And that's what I want to talk about today. To your question earlier, Mariam, I'd like to touch on all of those areas. I'd love to touch on them in detail, but I have a clock telling me that time is short, so I will whiz through. But of course, can answer any questions at the end. So cognitive needs evolve through the life course, from growth and development in those early years, those first 1,000 days of life, into toddlerhood, adolescence. It's a period of rapid growth with children. We then move into our middle-age years. Chandni, my colleague who is sitting here today, mentioned to me scarily yesterday that she perceives middle age as starting at 30. Now, I'm not saying I agree with that, but it is a time when you can actually have an effect on prevention and mitigation of future cognitive decline. But it's also a time when we're really thinking about improving performance, ensuring that we're acting at our best, you know, with our work life, with our family life. And then moving into the older years, again, I will say 55 plus years is not necessarily older or elderly. My marketing colleagues would disagree, and they think this is marketing to the elderly at 55. We've had many, many conversations about how that could be perceived. But anyway, we know that cognitive domains develop, peak and decline at varying stages of life. And there's different needs at each of those life stages. We know that a lot of cognitive decline and cognitive performance is modifiable by many lifestyle factors. So, you know, exercise, smoking, alcohol intake, but also nutrition. And that's what I want to talk about today. We know that nutrition is essential in developing, maintaining and preserving cognitive function throughout the life cycle. So where are the nutrient gaps in brain health across the life stages? I thought I would start with just a little bit of a picture. I don't know if you're visual. I'm always more of a visual person than words on a slide. But this is just a snapshot of the UK and the EU. And, you know, there are a number of micronutrients that are integral for brain health across all of those life stages I've just talked through. And you can see a lot of reds and oranges on this slide, which is not a good thing. So across multiple various life stages, at least in the UK and EU, and actually mirrored in some other countries globally as well, there are key deficiencies and insufficiencies across a number of these key critical nutrients. So you can see, obviously, iron, zinc. I've pulled out folate for pregnancy. Obviously, we know that B vitamins more widely are relevant for cognitive health, but actually, there's not very much from a deficiency perspective for the other B vitamins. But what I really want to draw your attention to are the last two rows there. So choline and the omega-3s. So these are two critical nutrients I wanted to touch on in a bit more detail today. And you can see that generally across the board, we're not getting enough of either of them. So particularly the omega-3 fatty acids. So if you look at National Diet and Nutrition Surveys, so NDNS in the UK, equivalents in Europe, We don't necessarily track intakes of EPA and DHA, which are the key omega-3 fatty acids found in fish. But we do track serum levels of omega-3 and fish consumption. And we know that consistently across all of these age groups, they're below recommendations. So that really stood out to me. I think when you see it like this, you think maybe we're not having enough. But actually, it's the data are very clear. This is from recent 2024 data as well, I believe. So again, I just want to touch on omega-3. So I know the title of this presentation is Innovative Ingredients. Now, arguably, omega-3 is not particularly innovative, but it is underconsumed and I think underappreciated, to be honest, because it has such key critical roles in cognitive health and brain health. So it's a key building block of brain cell membranes. It helps to control inflammation in the brain. It can influence genes that affect brain growth. And as I mentioned, low dietary intake of omega-3s is an important risk factor, particularly for brain and heart health. Now, outside of the UK and the EU, 76% of countries have been shown to consume less EPA and DHA on average than the minimal global recommended intake. And I'll come on to it very shortly, but that global recommended intake is already too low. So where is the gap? So I've talked through clear discrepancies between omega-3 dietary guidelines and intakes. The recommended daily intakes per life stage. So they're around 250 to 500 milligrams. Aside from infants, obviously, that's a bit lower. And this is what is recommended based on food-based dietary guidelines. And this is globally, not just for EU or the UK. I keep forgetting I have to split those up. It's a long time since we were part of the EU, but I still consider the UK and EU together. So 250 to 500 micrograms is what is recommended in food-based dietary guidelines. If you look at the data from clinical trials in the area of cognitive health, so prevention of cognitive decline and optimal functioning, particularly in healthy elderly, but also those with potentially age-associated memory impairment, you see positive effects at a minimum of 900 milligrams of omega-3. Actually, in those studies, it goes up to about 2 or 3 grams. So there's a clear discrepancy between what we're getting from an omega-3 perspective, what's recommended, and also what's shown in the science. And we also see that the average supplement contains not that much either. And likewise with choline. So moving on, choline's a key underappreciated nutrient, in our opinion. It's key for building neuronal cell membranes and key for brain and spinal cord development in children during pregnancy. And there's some very interesting data emerging actually around the synergisms between DHA status in pregnant women when co-supplemented with choline versus intakes of omega-3 alone. Again, you can see here that across the board, the recommended intake is exceeding what we are actually getting in our diet. And there may be many reasons for that. I mean, choline is not particularly abundant in food, and it's often not contained in brain health supplements. So aside from beef liver and eggs, which I'm not sure how well consumed beef liver is in the UK, not very well consumed. And with a move to plant-based diets, eggs are decreasing in popularity. There's not a ton of foods that contain a lot of choline, which is problematic because it is critical across all of those life stages. And we did a very quick internal search, and none of the 10 best-selling brain health supplements on Amazon contain choline. And I guess it's a challenge for the food industry because it is very hard to formulate into a supplement and have it taste good and remain stable over shelf life. So that was a whistle-stop tour, and I'm aware of the timing. I'm nearly done. A whistle-stop tour of some ingredients with what I would say quite confirmed evidence in the area of brain health. But what I wanted to move on to now is ingredients with a bit more emerging evidence in the area, so namely botanicals. So in the Holland and Barrett team, we have done a number of systematic reviews of botanical-based ingredients for various cognitive domains. So by cognitive domains, I'm talking about memory, attention, alertness, mood. And there are a number of botanical-derived ingredients with relatively good evidence in the area. So we conducted a systematic review just of human trials in all of these areas. And I was actually positively surprised by the amount of data that was out there. So why are there a lot of effects of botanicals, and what's driving those effects? So very briefly, I think the effect is being driven by a number of compounds, and there are lots in plant-based compounds, but predominantly polyphenols. So it may or may not be a phrase you're familiar with. They're a large family of naturally occurring compounds. They have diverse structures. And because of those diverse structures, they have very diverse biological effects as well. So they're found in fruits, vegetables, herbs, spices. Most importantly, they're found in wine as well, red wine specifically. And they're often responsible for the colour of plants, so the blue and blueberries, for example. And they have, myriad effects. So from antioxidant and anti-inflammatory to neuroprotective properties. And they likely work via a multitude of mechanisms of action. It's really hard to pin down exactly how they work. I could have a good go if I had more than about 3 minutes. They have an effect on vascular function. They may improve blood flow, reduce oxidative stress, and also modulate signaling pathways that are involved in cognitive function. So my last two slides, I just wanted to whiz through a few emerging ingredients that we've looked at internally that seem to have some good data behind them for various aspects of cognitive health. So firstly, in younger adults, and then a number of ingredients in older adults as well. So botanicals such as spearmint and mango leaf extracts, they may be better indicated for performance functions in younger adults. We've seen a lot of evidence that they improve focus, attention and alertness, but they may also have longer term neuroprotective effects too. So you can see here that 900 milligrams, a relatively high dose of a standardized spearmint extract versus placebo, showed an 11% increase in sustained attention when supplemented chronically. So I think that was 90 days, yeah. And likewise, there's a mango leaf extract on the market currently that has a similar effect at a much lower dose, actually, 100 to 150 milligrams. So you can see here on the right that when this mango leaf extract was given, and this is acutely rather than chronically, a single dose improved processing speed and the ability to handle complex tasks. So finally, in older adults, I find this the most interesting area, actually. And I will say, this makes me sound very boring, but curcumin is one of my favourite ingredients. I find it really fascinating. So it's the active ingredient in turmeric. And along with cocoflavanols, it's been indicated for improving or preserving working memory in older adults. So just a quick snapshot. There are a few more studies out there. I'm happy to provide afterwards if anyone's interested. But curcumin increased performance in various tests of working memory by 5 to 10% at 12 weeks. And cocoflavanol, so a high cocoflavanol drink, was shown versus a low cocoflavanol drink to increase brain-derived neurotrophic factor levels, so a kind of proxy marker, a protein strongly linked to memory, by approximately 15% at 12 weeks. So these are just highlighting a few ingredients. As you saw, there are many more. And the area of polyphenols, I think, in cognitive function particularly is fascinating. I think they have an effect both acutely and chronically. I think we see stronger data for a chronic consumption, but there are arguments for an effect both acutely and chronically. So again, it was a whistle-stop tour of potential innovative ingredients across the life course. I think some key takeouts: optimal nutrition is essential for cognitive health throughout life. Prevention starts early, scarily early in some cases, with each life stage having unique nutritional needs. Key nutrients are well-established nutrients like omega-3s and choline support cognitive function across all life stages, with emerging evidence in the area of phytochemicals and botanicals around mitigating cognitive decline. So while factors beyond diet like exercise and lifestyle do impact cognitive health, food and dietary supplements, I think, can play a significant supportive role. And the last thing to remember to take home is that 55 is not elderly. And also your cognitive health, prevention of decline and mitigation of any adverse effects starts super early. So start thinking about it way, way earlier. I think that is me. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Really great to have it brought over you. Not only the innovative ingredients, but also the message, don't forget the already traditional, well-established ones that maybe still deserve attention, like choline and DHA. We move now more to early life stress. And with stress, you always think maybe when you were a student, you have exams, or maybe when you get kids and you need to juggle between work, kids, etc. But actually, stress also plays a role in early life. So I'm happy to invite Dr. Aniko Korosi. She's Associate Professor at the Faculty of Science of the University of Amsterdam. And she will actually be talking about combating early life stress through nutrition. So the floor is yours.
So thanks very much for the invitation. And it's actually really nice and connecting really nice to Sophie's talk. So indeed, I'm at the University of Amsterdam. And just to remind ourselves, what do we mean with early life, and in the context of my talk in particular? And so we talk about the first 1,000 days of life, or actually from gestation up to the first 2 years of life. And we know that adversity during this period of time leads to a much more increased risk to develop a broad range of diseases. And actually, these diseases are both mental as well as metabolic diseases. And we also know that these diseases have a really strong sex bias in their presentation. And if you're interested, there is this review where we really looked into the early life origin of some of these interdependencies of these diseases. So can it be that early life adversity, for example, could be at the origin of the comorbidity and also of the relationship between this development of diseases, and also probably to the sex differences that these diseases present? But also what is interesting to realize is that if you think about early life adversity, this can take many different forms. And so when we think about early life adversity, we can think about abuse or neglect, but also, for example, maternal depression during the pregnancy, but also malnutrition. For example, we have really wonderful examples from the Dutch famine birth cohort, but also all the wars that are ongoing for us now. And what we see in the epidemiological literature is that actually the type of effects of these early life adversities are quite comparable independent of the fact that these stressors might be very different in nature. And if you put this together with the fact that these diseases that they are at risk, they are comorbid, and that the early life adversity leads to both of them, it becomes interesting to think of the early life adversity leading to a specific biology within these diseases, which might be particularly susceptible to nutritional strategies. And so one other aspect that I just like to highlight briefly is that when we think about early life adversity and the risk for diseases, we don't often think of Alzheimer's disease, but this is really the case. There is more and more increasing evidence also provided by us, but also a lot of other epidemiological literature, that early life adversity, among others, next to risk for depression or anxiety or other mood disorders, it's also linked to a higher risk to develop Alzheimer's disease. And I will show you some evidence that we have collected and how then we can think of nutrition indeed at very early stages to maybe even prevent some of these possibilities. So in the lab, what we do, I am a preclinical researcher primarily, and we really try to understand the neurobiological mechanism of how early life adversity leads to these effects and how it leads to this increased risk to develop these disorders, focusing primarily on the brain. I'm also interested, of course, in the mechanism of transfer. So when we think about early life, in all of these relationships, there is the mother with the infant, either still in the womb or during the postpartum period with lactation. So this mechanism of transfer by the placenta and by the breast milk and the mammary gland becomes, of course, very important and how this stress is transmitted. But in particular, for the talk of today, I will focus on the protective nutritional interventions that we are focusing on. We do this in a translational manner. I primarily do my work in in vivo mouse models, always in translation with human cohorts, but also more recently with interesting fish models, which can be also quite interesting in this context. Just to give you a really brief insight of what we do in terms of neurobiology, one of the aspects of we do this early life adversity, for example, in the mice, when we expose them for 1 week postpartum to an impoverished environment. So this is actually the stressor. And what we see is that these individuals that are exposed to this impoverished environment during this early life postpartum week, then they develop cognitive decline and they develop a lot of the features that are also present in the human conditions. So, for example, a smaller brain volume of certain specific brain regions, specific alterations in behaviors, also metabolic alterations that resemble cardiometabolic problems. We perform, of course, behavioral tasks, which help us to assess where are they with cognitive functions and with anxiety or mood emotional regulation. We focus on different aspects of the brain. Of course, the brain is very complex. We focus on different cell types, but in particular, I focus a lot on the neuroimmune system. On the neuroimmune system, so the microglia, you will hear me talk about microglia a lot. Those are the macrophages of the brain, and they are very important. And we think actually they play a really key role in how this early life adversity might prime the brain to react differently to secondary challenges or to other vulnerabilities and thereby develop further diseases. But this also might mean that there might be an excellent target for intervention. We focus on different mouse models and secondary challenges. That's not so relevant in this context. And just to give you a really small insight, for example, here we isolate microglia from the brains. And then we look at the gene expression profile in response to early life adversity. And what we see in the most right plot is that the gene expression of these microglia are very different in response to an immune challenge if the animals have been exposed to early life adversity or not. And in the lowest panel there, what you see is actually a validation in a postmortem human brain cohort where we had childhood abuse individuals and individuals that died of sudden death. And we see very similar changes in gene expression as the ones that we see in the mice, suggesting that this is a very valid biological model to study this mechanism and also to study then intervention strategies and whether this can be effective. So when we think about the nutritional interventions, as was mentioned already, there is increasing evidence. There is the whole field of nutritional psychiatry, all focusing on how we can modulate mental health with nutrition. This is largely focusing a lot on mood disorders, but also more and more, and of course, there's a lot of interest also in the context, for example, of Alzheimer's disease. But when you look in the literature, what is really missing, there are a couple of important questions that still remain, is like indeed, for who? Who individuals? Shall we just give the whole entire population some supports and supplements and that will be the key? Or should we have more personalized nutritions and seeing who are the individuals at vulnerability and who could benefit? And then which nutrients? I mean, we heard some examples. Should we give just a mix to everybody or can we target specific biologies or biological dysregulations with specific nutrients? And then when? Should we give it all life, in specific life stages? At what periods should we give them? And how? I think in medical biology, we are really used to have really specific mechanisms and understanding. And I think to turn over the epidemiologists, the psychiatrists and the geriatrists, we need to really provide mechanistic evidence of how this works also within the brain so that this can be very effective. So this is the piece of that I would like to contribute to. And we actually reviewed really recently all the evidence that is there for how nutritional interventions can counteract the impact of early life adversity. Some of it provided by us, but also by several other researchers. And kind of make us realize that actually nutrition, given even very early in life, can have really long-term beneficial effect, also to protect against early life adversity, induced deficits, but also probably for other vulnerabilities. So it can be a very, very powerful tool. And of course, well, I don't need to tell it to this crowd, but I think for my mechanistic understanding, it's really important to realize that nutrients are a lot more than just a source of energy or building blocks, but they're really signaling molecules. And I really focus on these specific signaling capacities of this and the properties of these nutrients to understand what mechanism in the brain might be affected and how this might be working. So I wondered within the context of my research, if this is the case, if I envision nutritional interventions to protect against early life adversity, is it the case that early life adversity actually alters nutritional levels within the brain? Do I have a deficit to begin with? And if so, can I reverse the long-term effect of early life adversity with nutrients? Which nutrients then, and via which mechanism? And I study in the group many different kinds of nutrients for different contexts. So I focus on fatty acids for obvious reasons, but also for short-chain fatty acids, really clearly important, for example, one of the metabolites produced by the microbiota. Essential micronutrients, choline was mentioned, but of course these are very important methyl donors, important for all kinds of epigenetic properties and epigenetic methylations. Focus on polyphenols and also on HMOs. So a large broad of audience, and then we focus on many different mechanisms. And of course, we cannot cover all of them, but we target specific mechanisms, knowing the properties and the signaling capacities of the different nutrients to start with. I think it's all, of course, it's a lot more complex than that. And we don't eat one nutrient at a time most of the time, but I'm really focusing more at the idea of specific supplementation rather than lifestyle changes or dietary changes. It's a different concept. So just to give you an example, of course, fatty acid, we know about the properties. Some of it was also mentioned earlier. But what I like to focus on is that these have really important inflammatory modulators. And importantly, when I talk to you about these microglia, the macrophages in the brain, these fatty acids and the derivatives of these polyunsaturated fatty acids are able to modulate directly how these microglia function. And these microglia have the job to modulate basically your neurons and your synapses and how they connect to one another and the membrane fluidity of all your cells, etc. And these microglia are able to differently produce cytokines, to differently be able to phagocyte or eat, to differently be mobile, depending on or modulated by these fatty acids. So very powerful. And so what we did an experiment in these mice where we exposed them to early life adversity, like the one I presented to you during one postnatal week. And then we provided them a diet that was enriched in these omega-3 fatty acids up to the adolescent period and to postnatal day 42, a little bit longer, to cover the full developmental period. And then everybody returned to normal diet, so early diet and early life stress. And then there was a gap in period, everybody back to normal caging, normal environment. And then we looked at the long-term effects on behavior and on all the mechanisms in the brain. Well, very first, immediately at postnatal day 9, after the early life adversity, we could see in this plot that actually the brain composition of fatty acid was altered. So this was really an eye-opener. Fatty acid is actually very well protected in the brain because it's so important. So to have even a minor reduction or a minor change in this balance of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acid can be actually very important. Now, what was really nice to see is that when we provided this diet, so at this point was only given to the mothers and via the milk supplemented to the offspring, reached the brain within postnatal day 9, we already were able to rescue the fatty acid levels in the brain. So it was very eye-opener also for what could be at the origin of this fatty acid deficit, of course. But then going beyond, what happens in adulthood? But you could see, this is one of the tasks that we do in these mice. It's called object location task. It doesn't matter. It's a task for memory function. And what you could see in the white and the black bar is that the black bar are the early life stress exposed mice, and these are deficit. So when they are below this bar, it means that they're just a chance level that they did not learn the task. And what you can see is that in the bars that are striped, the controls and early life stress no longer are different. So basically, this early life diet was able to protect against the cognitive decline that were caused by early life adversity. And in this paper, we did actually a large battery of tasks, and it was rescued on all of the tasks that we performed. So this was very powerful, and it's such a subtle change. We only modulated a little bit the precursors of these fatty acids. And then when we looked just on the last bar here, you could look at the microglia. This was one of the markers for microglia, these neuroimmune cells. And what you can see is that early life stress leads to this pro-inflammatory state in the brain, kind of again suggesting that this brain might be more susceptible to later life challenges and respond exaggeratedly or inappropriately to these challenges, and that might have a cascade of events leading to disease. And this increase in inflammation is no longer there when they are fed early in life a diet enriched in omega-3 fatty acid. Again, long-term programming by the diet, counteracting the long-term effects of this early life adversity, also on this level. Just to give you another brief example with essential micronutrients, what we meant, it was a group of micronutrients, all important for this one carbon metabolism, where you also see the choline that was just mentioned, but also folic acid, methionine, B12, etc. And these all together are really important to generate methyl groups. And these methyl groups are really important for DNA and histomethylation, which is one of the prime epigenetic mechanisms, which are important for lifelong changes in gene expression profile. So it's very important in the context of this long-term programming. And what you can see here is that when we, well, first of all, what we can see in this first plot is that early life adversity changes methionine levels in the brain. Again, for me, it's mind-blowing that certain nutrient levels are actually just different in the brain. And just like before, when we supplemented this diet to the mom and therefore via the milk to the offspring, this is able to rescue these levels. Even though here, even at a more elevated level, the stress still managed to impact it, meaning that probably there is either an elevated need in the stress brain or that somehow the absorption of it might be impaired. This is something that we don't know. Now, when we supplement, again, we are able to rescue the deficits. So this is, again, this object recognition task. We see that under the standard diet, the mice are impaired, and when they are supplemented, they are no longer impaired. Very powerful. And also, again, saying something about the redundancy of biology, because it's another completely different group of nutrients and yet having some beneficial effects. And then what was also striking to us, hinting to some extent of how this could work, this is a plot of stress hormones. And we know that immediately at postnatal day 9, normally speaking, these mice are very stressed. They have elevated stress hormones, so this corticosterone is elevated. And this is no longer the case when the mice receive this enriched nutrient. To me, this was also very interesting, and this is something that we are exploring further. And among others, what we did, we looked at this epigenetic that I just told you, this gene methylation profile. And what you can see in these bars is that, first of all, stress leads to certain alterations in red compared to the blue of gene expression profile. That when they have had early life adversity, they respond differently to this acute stress because the profile in the third column is different. But I think what I would like to spot mostly is that actually the last row, you can see if you compare the last two rows, they are entirely different. Again, they received this micronutrient only for 1 week during the early life adversity, and this was able to change lifelong the epigenetic profile within the brain in response to secondary challenges and etc. So that's very powerful if you think about how this could work. We also focus on polyphenol. I will not go into the detail due to time. So I will, but if you're interested, there is more literature on this. And also in this review, we kind of review a little bit the evidence and also what could be the mechanism. And I think the take-home message of our review is that in most of the cases, actually, there is a beneficial effect of real life adversity. And sometimes it's more directed to emotional behaviors, sometimes more directed to cognitive functions, and of course, taking into account different mechanisms. But there is more to explore, I would say. And just like a really small hint, when I think about how this real life stress could lead to these deficits in the brain, because of course, that's important if you want to target it. One of the possibility is that, of course, this comes from the input. And of course, the input comes from the breast milk. And so we set up this human cohort to study exactly this on the Amsterdam mother milk cohort to really study what is the effect of stress on the mothers, on her milk composition, with the idea that maybe we could supplement actually already the stressed mothers to prevent some of the negative effects that this maternal stress could have on her offspring. And of course, we do this translational research. We can also investigate all the mechanisms directly in the mice, within the mammary gland, within the brain, and within the milk of the mice, and so on. So I think what I would like to, as a take-home message for you tonight, is that animal models of early life adversity are translationally very valuable to understand early life-induced increased risk for mental health disorders and cognitive decline, and that nutritional interventions specific to supplements could be a new potential avenue for these interventions and protect in particular against this early life adversity induced risk and disease. And with this, I would like to thank all the people that work in my team, and of course all the funding agencies, because most of my work is funded by governmental funding. And thank you for your attention.
Great to see that you touch upon how important the very early life is, but also how you can study that, because that's always a challenge. And nice to see, I think, maybe that also the fish fatty acids came back again as potential ingredients. So thanks a lot. So actually, if you look at the field, where are still the main gaps that need to be filled, actually, to determine the role of nutrition and mental health? There you go, first.
Yeah, I think it's a very good question. I can speak broadly where I see the gaps in the area, and that, I suppose, is in the quality of the research. So there's a lot of research in nutrition and cognitive function, particularly around mood and stress, as you've talked through, Anika, in vitro models, in animal models, but the translation up to RCTs and human level studies is still, I would say, in most cases quite early days, and the studies in the field of nutrition are generally quite small and not often repeated with the same nutrient potentially. I think omega-3, okay, that's not the case. There are tons of big scale trials, but for me it's the consistency and the quality of the randomized controlled trials in the area of nutrition, not necessarily just for mental health, but I think that is probably more of an emerging area than other aspects of cognitive function as well from a nutritional perspective.
Okay, thank you. And in your area of research?
Yeah. No, so I think I completely vouch for what Sophie was mentioning, and also to realize that actually to just provide even to a clinical population the same supplement might not be as effective, and it might show maybe less good of a results. And I think so we need to really have like good biomarkers, also nutrient related biomarkers to begin with, to be able to adapt the supplementations to the individuals or to subpopulations of the individuals. For example, in the case of this early life adversity, what I know most of, they probably present a very different biology behind their cognitive decline that maybe some other individuals are. Maybe they have higher inflammatory levels, and so pro-inflammatory supplements might be more beneficial than others, etc. So I think a lot of the trials just select populations based on the disease definition, and we lack a little bit these measurements of baseline nutrient levels.
So on one hand, more maybe the quality go more to the clinical trials, on the other hand to biomarkers, but also differentiate people,
stratify.
Thanks. Any other last questions, maybe? Yes, in the back.
So about you spoke about the botanicals, correct? And various leaf extracts and all. So are there any, you know, emerging leaf extracts or botanicals which is more interesting? You refer to two of them, but if there's any more?
From my perspective, there are lots. There are absolutely tons with varying degrees of evidence behind them. I think for me, I did touch on it, but one that's quite overlooked for cognitive function is curcumin. So it's traditionally associated more with joint health and disorders of joint, osteoarthritis, etc. But I think there's some really nice emerging data for it, for cognitive function. And I think the kind of scarcity of the data for curcumin has been because it is not a very well-absorbed chemical compound. And what we're seeing in the industry is a lot more kind of technologies coming out to make those types of ingredients more available in the body. So I think that's a really interesting one. Personally, it's not really emerging, but I think blueberry extract is very, very interesting. So one I didn't touch on here. And also polyphenols coming from grape, generally grape juice. We see a lot around grape seed extract. I think the extract and the concentrated extract of the grape juice is also has a lot of emerging evidence behind it as well.
Yeah, thank you. Any other questions? Yes. Oh, wait, microphone is coming.
So thank you for your really nice presentation about the
That's all right.
It's about the microglia cells in the brain that cause the dementia. But what about the corticosterone levels in the blood and the effects of the nutrients on the corticosterones? You found it in the mice, but is it also possible to measure those in human?
Yeah.
And did you then find certain type of nutrients that could control these levels and prevent inflammation in the brain?
Yeah. So I think this is a very good question. So we are trying now to see what other because we have been also looking within the brain and we measure stress hormones, but this was at this very early stage. And often, unless you have a secondary challenge, you no longer have these elevated stress hormones later in life. So it's something that happens in the early biology, and probably these elevated stress hormones, which have also pro-inflammatory signaling, participate in the changes that we see in these neuroimmune cells. But we are looking at biomarkers for this early life adversity. For example, in this prenatal, I don't know if you've ever heard of the Dutch famine birth cohort. This is this cohort of individuals who have been exposed to undernutrition during pregnancy. And then now we have followed up their children, who are now around 75. And we have been looked in their blood to see, okay, are there individuals that developed further cognitive decline than others? And how early can we detect this in their blood? And we see at the age of 58, so way earlier, that there are changes, for example, in the lipid profile in the blood, which already gives an indication to who will develop cognitive decline later. So I think there is definitely a promise of that says that the biology of those individuals exposed to an early life adversity are different. Now, to make the link in human from blood biomarkers to the microglia in the brain, we are not there yet. I think there are some PET scans that can kind of give a hint to the neuroimmune functions in the brain. But that's why I think it's really important to have still animal models that help us, because I think these complementary in vitro models with human biology, they are great and they're fantastic, but they are far from an organism. And I think if you want to understand more about the mechanism of nutrition supplementation and cognition and behavior, then we still need the whole organism to be able to tackle these kind of details. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Before you go, we have some exciting news to share. In 2026, we're hosting two major events. We'll be in London in June, and we're back in Rotterdam in September. Visit foodmatterslive.com to register and join us as we inspire the future of food.